Hi, it's Tom here. And before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I just wanted to let you all know about an exciting new addition to Spiked, and that is our brand new Spiked online shop. Yes, you can now buy t-shirts, hoodies, mugs and tote bags bearing some of your favourite Spiked slogans, from Love Europe, Hate the EU, to Ban Nothing, Question Everything. It's full of excellent gifts for yourself or your most pro-Brexit, pro-freedom loved ones. So just go to spiked-online.com and hit the shop button in the top right corner to check out the whole range and make your purchases. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, Deputy Editor at Spiked, and this is the show where myself and the IEA's Chris Snowden discuss the latest news in public health killjoyism, all with the help of an invited guest. Today, we're joined by documentary filmmaker Martin Durkin to discuss the Great American Vaping Panic, the lies of the nanny state lobby, and the demonisation of smokers. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast on all things nanny state. I'm Tom Slater, and today, as ever, I'm joined by the IEA's Chris Snowden, fresh off the train from Tory conference and suitably hungover. Hello, Chris.
Hi, yeah, fresh is not the word I need.
Excellent. And today we're delighted to be joined by documentary filmmaker and polemicist Martin Durkin, the man behind such explosive films as Brexit the Movie, Margaret, Death of a Revolutionary, and The Great Global Warming Swindle. Martin, thanks for coming back on the show.
Cheers.
So I hear, Martin, you're working on two new films at the moment, both set in America, one on guns, one on race, both of which sounds like they'd be quite of interest to Spiked readers and listeners. Do you want to tell us a little bit about them?
Yeah, the guns one is pro-guns, obviously, pro-Second Amendment, and looks at the connection between guns and freedom historically and today, and argues that attempt to control guns is nothing less than an attempt by government to have a monopoly of force, and so argues vociferously against gun control on the basis of freedom, not on the basis of anything else but freedom. How much do we trust the state, and where does sovereignty lie? And the film on race looks at the wonderfully contentious issue of race and asks why, given that America is so much less racist today than it was, say, in the 1950s, there are still terrible problems, problems that by many indicators are worse than they were then for so-called black communities, family breakdown, education standards, levels of criminality and so on. And we look at the fact that a lot of the source of these problems are connected with the welfare state and the creation, the growth of the welfare state in the 1960s in America. But then, of course, if you're part of big government, you're not likely to blame big government. So where do you find the excuse if it's not rubbish schools and the intervention of government? Then it must be racism. And, of course, a lot of organizations are set up to combat racism, and those organizations cannot possibly see there being less of a problem. There must be more of a problem. So they redefine racism. It's not the old sort. It's systematic racism. It's institutional racism. It's racism in a glance, in a gesture, and so on and so forth. Mm.
And where can listeners find out more about them? Are you crowdfunding these? Am I right in thinking?
We're about to crowdfund one. I mean, we're pretty much determined to make them anyway, but yeah. We're getting a crowdfunding to get the money together, because no broadcaster obviously touch these with a bloody barge pole. The wonderful internet that's going to let us do it.
We look forward to those. So to kick things off, let's talk about something which we touched on last month, but has since exploded into a much bigger story, what Chris has called on Spiked the Great American Vaping Panic. So many listeners will have seen headlines recently about a string of deaths linked to e-cigarettes allegedly in the US. At the time of recording, the death toll is said to have risen to about 16 people in various states being taken ill, with some, as the New York Times call it, mysterious lung illness linked to vaping. But what we're not being told so often, what we touched on last month, is that what links a lot of these stories is the deaths were among people who were taken ill by smoking black market THC, effectively kind of cannabis vape juice rather than the legal safe products. But still, this story has fed a long-running war waged on vaping by US authorities and people in public health. So, Chris, we touched on this last month, but it has exploded since then. Could you give us just a little bit of background to those who haven't been following it, and an update, I guess, on where we're at the moment?
Yeah, I can't remember exactly what I said about it last time, but obviously it was a month ago. I'm not sure how many people had died at the time. I think it was only one or two. But even then, it was very obvious that this was not an e-cigarette issue. It was a black market THC cartridge issue. You could tell that from the fact that the majority of people involved admitted to having vaped THC cartridges, and the fact that these hospitalizations and deaths were clearly clustered in certain areas. And just logic would tell you that e-cigarettes aren't suddenly become fatal, having been used for a decade by tens of millions of people around the world. And those facts are they're even more obvious now. I mean, finally, in recent days, the Centers for Disease Control has put out some statistics saying that 77% of the people who've been hospitalized in this kind of outbreak have admitted to using THC vapes, but they are still pushing on and trying to implicate normal e-cigarettes on the basis that 23% of them haven't admitted to it. But admitted to it is the key phrase here, right? You know, this is an illegal drug. Cannabis per se is illegal in most states, and even in the ones where it's legal, it's not necessarily legal to buy THC vape cartridges. So it's really obvious. I mean, a good analogy, I think, is if you've got a whole load of people falling down with the same disease at a music festival and 77% of them admit to having taken exactly the same drug, then you don't assume there's two different causes here. You just assume that the handful of people who haven't admitted to it were taking it but don't want to say it because it's illegal. It's pretty obvious what's going on. The chances of e-cigarettes suddenly becoming fatal at exactly the same time and in the same places as vape cartridges are manifestly seriously affecting people is too outlandish to really consider. So it's been fascinating to watch it. I mean, I was actually over in America last week, and it's just rolling news. Mm. It's constant scaremongering about this. Quite irresponsible, I think, of the health authorities not to make it crystal clear from day one that this was a THC vape cartridge issue. Stay away from black market THC vapes. Instead, they've issued a general warning against vaping per se. And this has now started in the last week or so to feed into the UK media. I'd love to know how much orchestration and coordination's going on behind the scenes amongst people who've always been against vaping. There's a few quite high profile public health academics in Britain who've always been against it. They're never going to change their mind. They just have to win. It's a battle of attrition. Somebody has managed to unearth a supposed vape related death from 2010 in the very early days of e-cigarettes. It was an open verdict, and no one really knows any details about it at all. It's just this guy's wife has kind of raised it. And supposedly there have been 200 cases of various kind of miscellaneous lung injuries or other forms of illness linked to e-cigarettes, but not in any proven way. It's like, where does this stuff come from? How come we've never heard about these 200 cases? Why have we never heard about this guy before? It's all very suspicious.
Mm. Martin, what's your take on all of this?
Yawningly predictable. There is a certain group in society who will always want to find the regulating class, if you like, who will always want to find a problem. They will always want to find something that gives them an excuse to intervene, to regulate, to study, to analyse, to pass another law, and they will find it whichever way. It doesn't matter to them if it's irrational. The scare is irrational. It's got to be there, and it's got to demand, it's got to, you know, legitimise more funding, more legislation, and so on. So you kind of just know that it's coming. And, you know, no sooner they get rid of smoking, you know, which took years and years and years of bashing and bashing and bashing, you just know they're going to find a problem with whatever comes next. You know, apples are good for you, apples are bad for your teeth, apples are good for you. You know, it's just whichever which way, there has got to be a problem for these people. There has got to be a problem. And it doesn't matter what the science says. I mean, that's the sad thing. You know, we're here and we're chasing our tails, trying to point out the absurdity of pronouncements on global warming or on vaping or whatever. But it matters not to them. Mm. They don't give a stuff.
And Chris, what do people who are kind of pushing this panic have to say about the fact that, you know, you're outside of America, these kind of people have been vaping very safely for a long time. I mean, how is this kind of scare story, I guess, being sustained in the face of all the evidence? What is it that's pushing this? Who are the people pushing this?
The people pushing it are a whole range of anti-smoking turned anti-vaping activists. The climate of opinion in academia and public health in America is very different to the climate of opinion over here. We're almost an outlier in a sense, and the Public Health England and such like are really quite pro-vaping, and hopefully will hold the line in the face of this, you know, growing pressure. So yeah, it's pushed by a bunch of junk scientists and people who always had it in for vaping, who think vaping is a tobacco industry conspiracy. There's a gateway. I don't know if they even believe this stuff, but they certainly don't like people enjoying themselves with e-cigarettes. And there's loads of health groups. And, I mean, there is a follow the money aspect to this in that, I mean, all governments are, you know, dependent on tobacco taxes to some extent. But in America, it's at a whole different level because you've got this master settlement agreement, which is a big class action lawsuit from the late 1990s, which involves the tobacco industry paying the individual states supposedly for smoking-related diseases. And a lot of them have ended up buying, the states have ended up buying tobacco bonds. The amount of money they get from the companies depends on how many cigarettes are sold anyway. So the states have an incentive to encourage people to smoke, right? And to discourage them from quitting. So there's a whole load of different aspects to this, which turn this into a perfect storm for vaping. But it is kind of, yeah, it's a very good question. How are they able to ignore the rest of the world? Well, Americans kind of do that, you know, sometimes if they want to do it. It can be quite insular and inward-looking. They are able to kind of block out what's going on elsewhere. And, yeah, that does seem to be what's happening.
Martin, on the point about America, what do you make of the fact that, you know, America kind of held up for, rightly or wrongly, as a place where people are a bit more chilled out and free about various things in relation to lifestyle, speech, liberty, etc.? For some reason, it's actually patrician nanny state England, which is kind of far more pro-freedom in relation to something like vaping.
There's a degree of kind of love of freedom and toleration and all the rest of it in both Britain and America. But there's also the other element. And, you know, the warring sides are kind of, you know, get the upper hand at different points. In America, you know, which has obviously got an enormously strong a sense of individual freedom, Eisenhower, after the Second World War, warned of the emergence of the scientific, technical, administrative complex. After all the controls of the Second World War, after all the spending on public bodies, he warned that these are not going to dismantle themselves. They're going to grow and grow and grow, and it's going to be the, you know, that publicly funded science, administrative, health, education, arts funding complex that is going to be driving a lot of all this. And there's real coherence of it. We say, what, who's behind the kind of vaping thing? You will usually find that the same people who will get on the anti-vaping bandwagon will also believe in global warming. They will also be Remainers. They will also, you know, think mass tourism is bad. You know, there's a whole cluster of beliefs, a suite of kind of ideas, a worldview that goes with that university-educated, largely publicly funded class, where they will want to intervene. They will want to regulate. And it doesn't matter if there are ridiculous unintended consequences. It doesn't matter if the science isn't really there to justify it. It doesn't matter if the risk isn't real. There's got to be the threat of the risk. There's got to be some justification, because they know that's in their interest. They are the class that studies, that analyzes the research, that draws up the legislation, that draws up the ideas, that implements them, and so on. It is there, if you like, an old these mild Marxist past talking here, it's in their class interest to do this. And so they will, you know, follow it through with irrational vehemence. Mm.
Chris, where do you see this all going next? Because it's clear that the industry is taking a bit of a battering. I've noticed that the chief executive of Juul, which is obviously the big e-cig out there, Kevin Burns, has stepped down. They've withdrawn advertising across the US. Do you think just the industry, the vaping industry over there, is just going to get more and more battered, more and more isolated as this goes on?
It does look that way. It's not looking at all good for vaping at the moment. I mean, the industry is already faced with a lot of regulation from the FDA, which keeps getting pushed back. But at some point in the next few years, the idea is to take all e-cigarettes off the shelves anyway, unless they can be proven to be less hazardous than cigarettes, which you might think is an easy claim to prove. But actually, the way the system is set up, it's not at all easy. So yeah, it's looking bad. Juul, I mean, Juul is interesting because Altria, which is basically Philip Morris USA, they bought a third of Juul, bought 35%, I think, only about 3 or 4 months ago, just before all this kicked off. Juul's value then was £12 billion. So Philip Morris paid £4 billion for it. Sorry, dollars, I should say, dollars. And since that happened, since Juul sold so much of it to Altria, the value of the company's gone down by 35%. Actually, nice symmetry in the numbers. But so they've taken a big haircut on this. Juul is a big thing that I think differs America from UK on the vaping side of it. I think I might have said this last time, but Juul is phenomenally popular in America. It's got 70% of the market, and it does seem to be used quite a bit by high school students in a way that kids in this country don't tend to be very interested in e-cigarettes. So that was the background to this scare, right? So there was already a big moral panic around vaping, but the THC problem, which has been presented as an e-cigarette problem, took it to a different level.
Mm. You talked a little bit about contagion at the beginning. Do you think we're going to see some of that as well?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, there's definitely people in the UK who want to spread this over here. I don't know what they've got up their sleeve next. But, yeah, I've already seen this claim about 200 injuries or hospitalizations, whatever they're supposed to be linked to vaping in the last 10 years. They may carry on making this stuff up. Quite possibly. I mean, the media has an appetite for it. You know, these things do tend to go around the world because people start looking for a problem then, right? You know, so they dug through the archives to find this guy who supposedly died from vaping 10 years ago. They weren't going to do that unless there wasn't already a story in the States. I just think that probably touch wood, Public Health England is as entrenched actually as some of these anti-vaping activists. They're not going to suddenly do a U-turn on this, and they've got the truth on their side. So they are probably under a lot of pressure, but I think they'll hold the line.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. Okay, next up, let's return to minimum unit pricing on alcohol, an old friend of ours on this podcast. So, but specifically the kind of increasingly dodgy claims being made about it and its successes. So this is the Scottish government's flagship health policy aimed at tackling alcohol-related deaths, which the government claim is caused by overly cheap booze, finally introduced last year. And since then, there's been a kind of concerted effort to present this as an instant success story, often through cherry-picking statistics and a lot of selective reporting. A few months ago, we talked about this set of statistics that came out, one of which suggesting that consumption had gone down, and then a couple of days later, one of which showing that alcohol-related deaths in Scotland had actually gone up. Prizes for guessing which one was widely reported. And more recently, Chris, you've picked up on claims again that apparently both sales and alcohol-related deaths are supposedly down. So were we wrong last time, or is this more selective reporting of the evidence?
Horrendous junk science involved here. Just mind-boggling how brazen these people are. It's kind of interesting watching history being rewritten in real time, in the same way it's interesting watching a moral panic, you know, be fabricated in the United States. So, yeah, you're quite right. In, I think, June, the official government statistics came out just for the calendar year 2018. So only two-thirds of that involved minimum pricing because the policy didn't come until April. But still, it showed actually a fairly routine decline in alcohol consumption, 2.9%, nothing out of the ordinary. It falls more often than not in Scotland in recent years. But this, as you say, very widely reported, great success for minimum pricing, supposedly. Then the next week, actually alcohol-related deaths have gone up. Again, nothing sensational. It tends to fluctuate a bit, but that wasn't reported at all until 2 or 3 weeks ago when suddenly the news that alcohol-related deaths in Glasgow had dropped quite sharply, something like 20% decline, was reported everywhere. Now, this statistic, this wasn't a study. It was presented as being a study. It wasn't at all. It was actually just some guy making an announcement at a conference. But he'd just gone into the spreadsheet that the government had issued a couple of months earlier. And, yeah, overall deaths had gone up, but it breaks it down by different parts of the country, you know. And, of course, if you cherry-pick one particular place, happened to be Glasgow where it'd fallen, you can use that in isolation and imply that minimum pricing is the cause of it. But if you'd gone to, you know, Aberdeen, they would have found a 70% increase. And, I mean, you know, the point is you look at the figures overall, unless you're a crook, right? So it's obvious that these people are going to stop at nothing to present minimum pricing as a success. And this most recent study is unbelievable. So the actual figures for the off-trade, and it's the off-trade we're interested in. Minimum pricing is not going to affect pubs and restaurants. But the actual figures in the off-trade show roughly a 2% rise in alcohol sales in the first 9 months after minimum pricing began. These are kind of official proper sales figures from a company that is not Nielsen, but it's like Nielsen. The study that came out in the, I think, British Medical Journal said that there was a 7.6% decline in alcohol sales in the off-trade in the 8 months after minimum pricing came in. And it's like, how can you possibly say this? And you look at the study, and over and over again, it says there was a fall of 7.6%. We believe this is due to minimum pricing. And you go, oh, this wasn't. So how do you make this claim? And it's not particularly clear, even if you read the full study, but basically it's a modelling. I think we've talked about this modelling stuff before. Mm. You know, you go into the data retrospectively and you just fit it and you say, well, we'll make up a counterfactual here in which alcohol sales rose quite a lot, had minimum pricing not came in, we'll look at the difference and we'll call it fall. But it's not a fall. I mean, as an academic exercise, you can maybe justify this kind of what-if scenario, but it's not really proper science, and it's clearly biased by, you know, having people who are big supporters of minimum pricing do it in the first place. But the reality is there was not a fall. This is the important point. And so when the media, as it inevitably did, report it as a decline, it's just basically fake news. What else can you call it? You know, but presumably this stuff will just keep on emerging and the official story will be minimum pricing has worked when it doesn't seem to. And I'm not saying we might not get some sensational decline in alcohol related deaths next year. I don't know. But if they're going to take a rise in alcohol sales and present it as a decline, I mean, they'll do anything, I think.
Things I understand, obviously, why the public health bodies and the academics kind of push these very selective statistics, and obviously the politicians who prominently backed those policies in the past. But Martin, why do you think the media so credulously kind of report these things or selectively report these things?
Well, they're part of the same class. People who go into the media are part of the university-educated new class, and they club together on all sorts of these issues, and so they will tend to, you know, go along on this as with everything else. Someone say good on the Scots for still getting pissed. I mean, you know, every time you see someone hitting back at this awful sort of regulating blob, there's a university-educated smug new class thing. You just want to kiss them. If I see someone smoking tabs, I just want to kiss them. You know, when they say they were not allowed to use certain words, they're just saying, I want to call girls birds and talk about tits. You know, just anything to annoy them, anything to get back at them is rather encouraging. The sad thing is, of course, if you do raise the price of things enough, then you will kill them off. You know, if you raise the price of energy with green policies, then old ladies will get cold. If you raise the price of petrol, then fewer people will be able to afford to travel. If you raise the price of labour with a minimum wage, there will be fewer jobs. You know, there are consequences to all of these things, and not all of them pretty consequences. But also what they don't say is what's to blame, because obviously it's not really good that, you know, Scots people drink 55 bottles of vodka a year or whatever it is. But what people don't think about is the cause for a lot of Scots getting really pissed. And, you know, unemployment in Scotland was the result of government intervention in the 20th century. Industry used to be huge in Scotland, but the government intervened to form mergers and monopolies and fix prices and put down competition, and with disastrous results. And then when those disastrous results really got bad, they nationalised the company with even more disastrous results, leading to the burgeoning of welfareism in Scotland, which itself, you know, has had awful consequences. But of course, the government will never blame that, because that is to blame itself. So it looks at the side effects, like drinking, and then it'll try and regulate that. And of course, that will have unintended consequences, like Prohibition did. But they don't mind these unintended consequences, because that's just an excuse for even more legislation and even more laws.
Chris, there's been a lot of talk recently about lying in politics, spin, misinformation, this idea that the Leave campaign invented all of those things in 2016. A lot of that is quite overcooked. But at what point, you know, when we're talking about this public health stuff in particular, are these, they're just being so incredibly dishonest and lying? I mean, you, on your blog, pointed particularly to this statement put out by Nicola Sturgeon, which was just a complete inverse of the truth. I mean, at what point does spin and, you know, cherry picking and things that are just par for the course on some level, whether we like it or not, cross the line into something else? And have we reached that with a lot of these nanny state policies?
I think in common parlance, you would call it lying. Really. I mean, it's a lie, right? It's a lie to say that alcohol consumption fell at all after minimum pricing in this time period, but that is what's being claimed. There is usually a certain degree of plausible deniability in this, right? So a study has come out purporting to show a decline in alcohol consumption. Nicola Sturgeon can say, well, this is a peer-reviewed study. I'm just citing it in Parliament, saying that minimum pricing has been a wonderful success. Aren't I great? But I've got a reference for this. The people who did the study can say, oh, look, we never explicitly said that it actually fell. We just said that compared to a counterfactual based on our model using, you know, perfectly respectable statistical techniques, so we think that's the difference between sales as they actually were and sales as they would have been. It's not flagrant lying as such. I mean, it has that result. I mean, the end result is people are being told something that is the opposite of the truth. So I don't know what other words most people would use. It's very reminiscent, actually, of 15 years ago when smoking bans were starting to take over, and New York brought in a smoking ban, Ireland brought in a smoking ban. And the cherry picking of picking Glasgow and ignoring the rest of Scotland is very similar to what they did with the Helena Miracle, which is this thing. Helena, Montana, little town, saw a notable, I think 40% decline in heart attacks after a smoking ban came in. Now, this was just cherry picking, right? There was no general. You know, nobody looked at Ireland or California, any large areas. They looked at a place like Helena, Montana, which turned out to have an average of about 6 heart attacks per month, right? So it's quite easy to get a 40% drop if one or two people just don't happen to have a heart attack. And it was later shown to be cherry-picked nonsense, but that claim was used for a very long time. And then you've got the retrospective modelling. So it was said that there was a, to be fair, quite small, but 2% decline in heart attacks in England after the smoking ban. You look at a graph, heart attacks have been falling pretty consistently for a very long time, and they fell at exactly the same rate after the smoking ban as they had done before. But again, it came to, we modelled, we put a few variables in here, and we think actually it wouldn't have gone down at the same rate as it always has done. We would have gone down at a slightly lower rate. So again, is it a lie? Is that a lie? I mean, there's a lot of plausible deniability. It's true that heart attacks fell in Helena, Montana. It's true that alcohol-related deaths fell in Glasgow last year. But the final product of these truths amounts to a lie.
Hmm. And Martin, you spoke a second there about the kind of small acts of resistance against a lot of this nanny state stuff. It's something we've talked about a lot in this podcast. And I think you said actually last time you were on that there's always been a bit of a muted response because people aren't suddenly going to go on demonstrations holding up placards about minimum pricing. It's just not the sort of thing that you know, generates that kind of kickback. But do you think that you know, in recent years, particularly in Scotland, actually, you know, the response to the Iron Brewery formulation, you know, the fact that whenever Jamie Oliver opens his mouth these days, people are all over social media having to go at him over turkey twizzlers or school lunches or whatever. The fact that Boris Johnson brought up the sugar tax recently and got in a lot of trouble for it. Does it feel like this is more of an issue than it used to be, the nanny state stuff, that there is more of a kind of agitation against it?
Oh, yeah. And you can see it in, you know, in the deplorables, in the election of Trump, and you can see it in the rejection of all the Brexit stuff as well. You know, with Brexit, the experts were lined up and they said with the power of economic science behind them that it was going to be this, that and the other. But people are seeing through it. I mean, you can see with Brexit that people don't give a stuff. All of the health scares, people don't give a damn. GM food. Remember the GM, you know, GM food was all going to turn us into bananas or something because it would affect our genes. All of that stuff was absolutely huge. But luckily, I think the vast majority of, especially working class people, I mean, real people in private, you know, in the commercial sector of the economy, really don't give a damn. And they're not buying it. And that's the really encouraging thing recently. And you're right, they're not going to get out in the street and have a placard saying, oh, no, it's not true. But there's a massive passive resistance to it and a willingness to give the blob, that group that we've been talking about, a bloody nose.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. Finally, let's turn to our last topic of the day. And the question really of, is it ever okay to spray smokers in the face with a fire extinguisher? So this was raised by a quite strange viral story about a restaurant owner in Salt Lake City in the US who sprayed a fire extinguisher in the face of a man who was refusing to put out his cigarette while smoking outside of his business. I think the man was smoking next to the seating area of the restaurant, and Utah law prohibits smoking within 25 feet. So they had a quarrel about this. He sprayed the bloke at close range. It's a bit of a mad story, but does it tell us something maybe about the war on smoking, the demonization of smokers, and the kind of self-righteousness that this has bestowed on anti-smoking people or restaurateurs at least? Chris, I might be reaching a bit here, but what was your take on all this? Do you think it revealed something?
Yeah, and I think the fact that it is actually the law not to smoke within 25 feet of buildings in this place is interesting because it gives license to people who are, you know, who normally in saner times would be confined to the absolute lunatic fringes. 25 feet. I was just in Washington, D.C. recently, and they have the same law there. You can't, you know, you're walking down the street, but you can't smoke within 25 feet of a building. So where are you supposed to smoke? 25 feet, logically, is the middle of the road, which seems unsafe, right? But maybe that's the whole idea. We just get the smokers in the middle of the road and knock them down, and it'd be a great victory for tobacco control. There probably is quite a bit of hostility and hatred towards smokers. I don't think there's that much of it, actually, in this country. I think the government has done its best to try and whip up hatred towards smokers, but I don't sense that it's a widespread thing. In fact, you know, opinion surveys still show to this day that most people would be happy for pubs to have a smoking room. You know, so we're not, we haven't been completely bewitched by these decades of propaganda. I think it is a bit different in America. I think there is a genuine puritanism, a genuine fear as well. I mean, especially in places like California, they really do believe like a whiff of cigarette smoke outdoors could give you a heart attack and kill you. You know. So, yeah, weird hypochondria. But it's not, it can't be healthy, can it, for the government to be actively encouraging hatred? There was a campaign, TV campaign from the NHS, good 12, 13 years ago, probably, if not more, which just ended with the slogan, "If you smoke, you stink." That's all it said. And it was the gist of the film was it was some attractive woman trying to get off with this guy in a nightclub, and then he's about to kiss her, and then he sees her horrible stinky teeth and runs a mile, and then she sits down there feeling thoroughly miserable, and it says, "If you smoke, you stink. NHS, get help." So that's that element of what they call denormalization is indistinguishable from demonization, from stigmatization, as far as I can see. And so it's not surprising that you get some lunatic like this guy essentially assaulting somebody for smoking the outdoors.
Martin, what did you think of that video?
I think it's demonstrative of intolerance in a certain class. I don't think it's sort of you can say
all about the class today.
I really am. I've got a beer in my bonnet. But it's true, you know, if you go to a building site and you have a sort of sneaky gasper, you know, one of the builders aren't going to come out saying, "How dare you smoke?" Da, 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 da. It's going to be some university educated lefty member of the new class who gets a beer in his bonnet about that. You know, there is just no way in that if you're a trailer trash, you know, America, people don't give a stuff. You know, it's if you're somewhere where there are global warmers about, you know, that's the intolerant class. They're the ones who will really scream if you use the wrong word. Will absolutely throw things at you if you say that you voted Brexit or whatever it is. There is that intolerant, university educated, left leaning, statist, middle class perspective of that regulating class, and they are vicious. They're intolerant. They're single minded, and it stems from a lack of respect of the freedom of others. And that the whole class is based on regulating us. So it can't ever concede that actually people should just be left to their own devices, work it out themselves, make their own choices, decide if something might be risky or not risky. They cannot be left to their own devices. They have to be shepherded by them, the guardian class. And they are, I mean, you can see it in Brexit. They've got red gleaming eyes in there and their tails wag and their teeth come out and they want to kill you. They want to kill you. I live in Hackney, and I used to go to dinner parties, obviously, before I stopped being invited because I'm a Brexiteer. But, I mean, they are – I mean, they – you know, maybe it's good we don't have guns because they'd shoot me.
The self-righteousness is a fascinating point. I thought it was funny at one point in the video where after he's just, you know, giving this guy the fire extinguisher in the face, someone says, "Call the cops," and he says, "Call the cops." Like, it's just so confident. But Chris, you were talking there about the denormalization stuff. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that, because it is the great kind of lie of nanny state stuff that this is just about, look, we don't care what choices you make, just don't do it around people that it might hurt, don't do it around your kids, you know, don't smoke secondhand smoke on people who don't want it. But really, the underlying stuff of a lot of this is pushing people around, is telling them what is good and bad behaviour. You know, that's been, could you tell us a little bit about that and the denormalization aspects to?
Well, the denormalization idea came about a long time ago, in the 1980s, really, when smoking was basically pretty normal. It's not like most people smoke, but a hell of a lot of people did smoke, and it was considered perfectly normal to smoke in an office and to smoke in an aeroplane, indeed, let alone pubs and restaurants. And the idea was we're going to make non-smoking the norm. That's what it originally meant. But it very quickly, and I think inevitably, turned into we are denormalizing you as a human being. You are now a second-class citizen. And now in places like America, where you're not allowed to smoke indoors and you're not allowed effectively to smoke outdoors, you're just not allowed to smoke and you're not allowed to smoke in your own flat. I mean, all public housing now in America has a smoking ban in it. Because we can't have secondhand smoke, you know, slipping out a window and going to somebody else's window because it might kill them. But it's obviously just to stop people smoking. The secondhand smoke stuff was always nonsense anyway. It was weaponized because they didn't feel they could actually ban the sale of cigarettes, so they just ban you from using them anywhere. It has the same kind of effect. And I, you know, I don't smoke anymore, and sometimes I forget about how rough it is being a smoker. But it really is. It's so vindictive. It's so unnecessary. I mean, I'm just vaping now, but I'm thoroughly sick of traveling because you just can't vape anyway. You know, you get an airplane, you get on a train, you can have a cheeky buzz somewhere. But, you know, basically non-vaping has already become the norm for no obvious reason. And you see signs up saying no smoking, this includes electronic cigarettes. Well, you don't smoke electronic cigarettes. So what do you mean it just includes them? And I think I said on the podcast before that the people with the big sub-ohms are largely to blame for this by being antisocial. But it's still a nuisance, and it's so unnecessary. You know, we didn't have to include every single pub, restaurant, working men's club, private members club in the smoking ban. We obviously could have had designated smoking rooms. But if we'd have done that, that's how it would have always stayed, you see. And the anti-smoking people knew that. They said, if you create what is effectively a nice compromise that accommodates both non-smokers who essentially do have it as the norm that you don't smoke, but there is a room smokers can go to. Smokers would be okay with that. Non-smokers would be okay with that. You'd have a fairly harmonious society, and there would be no excuse for pushing it further. So a lot of these guys quite literally would rather not have a smoking ban at all than have one with exemptions to it. They'd rather wait until they can push for a full ban on smoking, then have a compromise which is probably going to stay there because most people are basically happy with it.
Yeah, they're also against genetic engineering of tobacco to take out the carcinogens. You know, it is not, you know, the point is not safety. All the time, you know, there are really terribly unsafe things about all sorts of things these people try to pass. Not about safety, it's about control.
Chris, Martin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.